We're finally in the lazy, crazy, hazy days of summer, so that means you should listen to me spend time in an undisclosed underground location away from that darn sun while I drink a beer and talk about interesting stories that I read on the internet. My name is Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, a show in which I do exactly what I just said. Drink a nice beer and talk about cool tech-related stories that I read last week. I do this show because I like beer and technology and want to put out some positive news out in that very hard world about human ingenuity and their lovable strangeness aspects, and to be able to enjoy the entire taste spectrum of the best beverage on the planet, which is beer. And to help me choose a different beer each week, I use a device called the Randomizer, which you're hearing right now, to make a selection from the private stock I keep here in the I'll Have a Beer and Talk bunker. We'll have the result in a few seconds. Aha! This week I have Blackberry Farm Brewery's Brett Belgo IPA, a 6.3% ABV Belgian IPA. Let me say that real fast, just to test my strength in speaking correctly and distinctly. Blackberry Farm Brewery's Brett Belgo IPA, Belgian IPA. Whew! Belgian IPAs are inspired by the venerable American IPA and double IPA styles. Belgian brewers amp up the use of American hops, but still use Belgian yeast strains to produce an IPA that has a cleaner bitterness and a more pronounced dryness than the regular old IPA. And, according to Beer Advocate, fantastic billowy heads that mesmerize! Cool. This one has a cork in it, so cover your ears once I switch to the beer mic. Well, it definitely has a fantastic billowy head, and it is mesmerizing me. It's a very, very pronounced, slightly off-white head, and kind of a peachy, orangey color, and it smells very much like a Belgian beer, very fruity. So, let's see what the Belgian take on the IPA is. That is an amazing contrast. The taste is actually quite bitter, but not an aggressive hop bitterness, just bitter, which is completely juxtaposed against the fruit smell of it all. This is really nice, really smooth. Well, unless you don't like bitter things, and just wonderful. Belgians make the best beer every time. Hey, remember how I talked about Kentucky Fried Chicken's Zinger 1 space probe 2 weeks ago? The chicken sandwich that they sent to the edge of space, well, not really the edge of space, but the edge of the atmosphere, as part of a co-branding marketing effort between KFC and Worldview Enterprises? Flying Pizza Tech. Ring a bell? Well, I have an update on the mission posted on space.com. Yes, it's time for some FU follow-up. To recap, Worldview Enterprises and KFC sent a chicken sandwich in a special satellite and chicken bucket-inspired container up to the upper atmosphere attached to a balloon to promote KFC's new Zinger chicken sandwich and Worldview's Stratolite balloon. The sandwich is meant for eating, and the balloon is meant to be an inexpensive, long-duration, high-altitude platform for various things that one would want to do at a high altitude, like atmospheric studies, geographical surveys, or act as a low-cost satellite network for providing things like high-speed internet access to large and/or remote areas. The Stratolite was meant to be in operation for 4 days after launching on June 29th, but after 17 hours, the flight had to be ended, quote, due to a small leak in one of the company's innovative new altitude control balloon systems, said Jane Poynter, Worldview CEO. Poynter then said that they were, quote, extremely pleased with the results from the brief mission, stating, many of these systems were flown for the very first time and tested together simultaneously. Pending an analysis of large amounts of flight data and key learnings from this mission, Worldview plans to launch additional Stratolite test missions with increasing flight duration in the near future. It's a nice way to put a positive spin on a balloon that didn't fly. Well, anyway, the collaboration with KFC was to increase public attention to the potential benefits that Worldview's Stratolite balloons could provide, and to also promote KFC's new chicken sandwich, the Zinger. You can check out photos and some, I'm told are supposed to be funny videos of Colonel Sanders giving mission updates at actuallysendingachickensandwich2.space. Yes, that is the URL. actuallysendingachickensandwich2.space. To lower Earth orbit and your stomach! And I have another bit of FU, which I do need to remind you stands for follow-up and nothing else. This is an update to the saga of growing vegetables on Mars. Like, oh, potatoes? Gizmodo has the sad news that it might not be possible to grow potatoes on Mars after all. In a study published in Scientific Reports, detailing the data collected by researchers at the University of Edinburgh, it appears that the components present in Martian soil, when combined with UV radiation from Martian sunlight, makes the soil a terribly effective bacteria killer. And bacteria is kind of necessary to grow plants in soil. The researchers tested how a little bacteria called Bacillus subtilis would react to perchlorates, which are naturally occurring chemicals found in Earth soil, as well as Martian soil. Perchlorates are what makes water still exist on the Martian surface in the form of a salty brine, and some bacteria can use perchlorates as a fuel source here on Earth. The team put B. subtilis in a bath of simulated Martian solution of magnesium perchlorate and subjected it to the UV radiation levels found on the surface of Mars. The bacteria died within 30 seconds. They repeated the experiment on a simulated Martian rock environment on a chunk of silica with the perchlorates present, and most of the bacteria still died. The researchers wrote, "Although the toxic effects of oxidants on the Martian surface have been suspected for some time, our observations show that the surface of present-day Mars is highly deleterious to cells, caused by a toxic cocktail of oxidants, iron oxides, perchlorates, and UV irradiation. However, we show the bactericidal effects of UV irradiated perchlorates provide yet further evidence that the surface of Mars is lethal to vegetative cells and renders much of the surface and near-surface regions uninhabitable." Gizmodo does point out that this study only involved Bacillus subtilis and no other types of bacteria, so there is a chance other bacteria may survive on and in the Martian surface. They spoke to Lynn Rothschild of NASA's Ames Research Center, who said that she and a team recently conducted similar research, and it suggests, quote, bacteria could withstand the perchlorates and salts on Mars. But for right now, if you have dreams of being a Martian potato farmer, you might want to wait a little bit longer to get all the information. Oh, Gizmodo, you sure know how to write a headline that catches my attention. Saturn's moon Enceladus has toxic booze on its breath. Sounds intriguing, right? A research team at Cardiff University were making ground-based observations of Saturn's E-ring, the second outermost ring. They detected an, quote, unexpectedly large methanol trace. Now, methanol is a highly toxic form of alcohol, so don't start filling up your space-based growlers. The team traced the methanol spray all the way back to Enceladus, which is firmly situated in the E-ring. The presence of toxic methanol emanating from Enceladus is unfortunate. The icy moon has long been favored to be a place where we might find some kind of primitive alien life beneath its surface. But with a toxic stream of booze coming from it, it's now pretty unlikely. It's already understood and has been observed that Enceladus spews water, hydrogen, and simple organic molecules from beneath its icy surface into space, probably from a subsurface liquid ocean. But the discovery of methanol is relatively new. NASA's Cassini spacecraft detected molecules like methanol in Enceladus's plumes during its still ongoing exploration of the Saturn system, but this is the first time it has been observed from ground-based telescopes. Emily Drabek-Maunder of Cardiff University presented the findings on July 4th at the National Astronomy Meeting and made this statement. "Recent discoveries that icy moons in our outer solar system could host oceans of liquid water and ingredients for life have sparked exciting possibilities for their habitability. But in this case, our findings suggest that the methanol is being created by further chemical reactions once the plume is ejected into space, making it unlikely it is an indication for life on Enceladus." Oh well, space life forms can't handle their booze. Shucks. Hey, did you know that making paper isn't hard? Not hard at all. You just need water, pulp, a mold and deckle, and some learning. You can get all that at this show's sponsor, Pulp and Deckle. Pulp and Deckle is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio, and its mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, and by creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, check out membership options, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, because we're all about the future, and check out all the amazing things we do with the art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckle.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. Mention I'll have a beer and talk, and we might give you something special. Wink. I haven't talked about advances in human prostheses in a while, so here's a story from The Verge about a mostly useless, but still cool, extra prosthetic digit. London Royal College of Art grad student Danny Clodes decided to take the term prosthetic and apply it literally. Speaking to Dezine, she says, "The origin of the word prosthesis meant to add, comma, put onto. So not to fix or replace, but to extend. The third thumb is inspired by this word origin, exploring human augmentation and aiming to reframe prosthetics as extensions of the body. The third thumb," she references there, "is an extra thumb that you strap on the side of your hand, opposite where your real thumb, hopefully, lives. It connects to a bracelet containing its mechanical drives. It is controlled by pressure sensors that the user places under the soles of their feet, and the data from the sensors is sent via Bluetooth to the bracelet, which then causes the thumb to make grasping motions." Now, that may sound creepy, and also like you'll never learn how to control it properly, but I'm pretty sure you already do something that involves communicating with remote mechanical objects using foot controls while also moving your hands. Can you guess what this thing is that I am talking about? Time's up. How much did you wager? Well, you know what? I'm talking about driving a car. Anyway, this is an art project. It isn't meant to become a consumer product, and is meant to reimagine how we perceive prosthetics, in that this isn't replacing a lost function of the human body, but is adding a function to the human body. It's kind of like how my bottle opener ring is slightly magnetic, so I can actually feel magnetic fields if I'm close enough through the ring through my finger. It's a sixth sense. That being said, all I can think of about this third thumb is, shut up and take my money! Think about how many beer bottles I could carry in each hand if each one had an extra thumb. Sweet. It's summertime, and with that brings mosquitoes. Gross. I recall that mosquitoes would get so bad in upstate New York that my father installed a bug zapper on the back porch. It was effective, but it also happened to kill every bug that it attracted. Not a big deal for a suburban home, but using that kind of indiscriminate bug-killing machine would not work well on a farm. Some bugs are good, and you want them to help crops grow, and some bugs are bad, and you want them all to just die. According to Engadget, there is a device which can decide which good bugs can live and which bad bugs will die, and it does it with lasers. Seattle-based Intellectual Ventures Lab, which sounds like it was started by Dr. Thaddeus Venture, which it wasn't, have developed a device called the Photonic Fence, which also sounds like it came from Dr. Venture, but it didn't. It has been in development for the past 8 years, but according to a report in Wired magazine, it has been, quote, installed on a U.S. Department of Agriculture site in the state for its first real-world test. The photonic fence scans for pests within 100 meters, or, in American, roughly 328 feet, using cameras and the mysteriously worded phrase, quote, other optics. Watching each located insect's, quote, form, velocity, acceleration, and wingbeat frequency. As you'll recall, mosquito species can actually be identified by the frequency of their buzzing, so this is entirely feasible. When a bug has been determined to be a bad bug, the photonic fence fires a laser and kills the bug dead within 25 milliseconds of confirmed hostile intent. According to Intellectual Ventures Lab, the photonic fence can kill up to 20 insects per second and can cover areas about 30 meters wide and 3 meters high. It's actually more of a dome than a fence, but would you rather have a photonic dome or a photonic fence protecting your crops? That's a tough one, actually. Anyway, no one knows when the test will begin or how long the trial period is, but this could be enormously helpful. Imagine replacing pesticides, especially the bee-killing kind, with arrays of these photonic fences and deploying clusters of these in areas rife with malaria-carrying mosquitoes. And if you thought hearing a bug get electrocuted in a zapper was cool, imagine the satisfaction of hearing the bad bugs pop while they're being blasted. Pew, pew, pew. Pop. Speaking of bees, Gizmodo reports that a group of researchers published the results of a study in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences about bee visual perception. It has been previously thought that a honeybee, in order to recognize the colors of a flower it had already visited, even in varying light conditions, had a capacity for something called chromatic adaptation. Basically, if an object is red but illuminated with a green light, the observer understands that the object is actually still red. A mathematical theorem based on chromatic adaptation called the von Kreis transform has been used in digital camera technology to reproduce accurate colors, assuming the manufacturer of said camera didn't cheap out on the light sensors. Cheap cameras have lousy color reproduction. The new research on the B-Vision shows that they have a different way of perceiving colors, a way that could be replicated for improved camera technology. As you should know, bees have two compound eyes, which they use to look at flowers they're visiting. On top of their little bee heads, however, are three ocelli, which are simple, primitive versions of an eye, all of which are aimed up at the sky. Each ocelli have two color receptors that sense the ambient light. By mapping out the neural connections of these ocelli, it was discovered that the information from the ocelli were being fed into the color processing areas of the bee brain. By combining the data from both the eyes and the ocelli, the bees can effectively filter out natural colored light and identify the color of flowers extremely accurately. One of the coordinators of the research, Adrian Dyer, said, "This discovery on color constancy can be implemented into imaging systems to enable accurate color interpretation." So thanks to bees, having to white balance everything might become a thing of the past. Hooray! I know I've mentioned this in the past, but my wife and I are urban chicken farmers, as well as papermakers. We currently have four hens and our flock, two pullets, which basically means chicken teenagers, and Grace Jones and Butterbean, who are not of laying age yet, and two elders who have been providing us with fresh eggs for a while. Our silver-laced Wyandotte, Lilith, gives us small, pointy, salmony pink eggs, and our buff Orpington, Romana, gives us large, almost spherical, light pink ones. Each chicken species produces eggs of different colors and general shapes. I never put much thought into why eggs from various bird species are all shaped distinctly from each other, but thanks to an article from The Verge, I know now that it has to do with how well each of those bird species can fly. As recently published in the journal Science, a team of researchers at Princeton figured it all out. They analyzed the shapes of almost 50,000 eggs, representing 1,400 bird species, from photographs in the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at UC Berkeley's online database. Online egg database. Neat. They wrote a custom computer program to analyze how elongated and how pointy each egg was, and used the resulting dataset and built a map of egg shapes. They then compared egg shapes across bird lineages and pulled in other information, such as the species' diet, where the nests are usually located, and how big the birds can get and how adept they are at flying. The data suggests that good flyers tend to lay pointy and long eggs. Fast-flying birds have evolved to be sleek and relatively small. Their organs are more compressed to improve aerodynamics. Because of this, their natural method of egg formation is altered. Every female bird has a stretchy tube called the oviduct, where their eggs form. When egg white and yolk form in the oviduct, an equally stretchy membrane is deposited around them, which gives the egg its basic shape. Then the shell forms around the membrane. The birds that are better at flying, due to the compressed internal structure, have a narrower oviduct, meaning the eggs produced have to be pointy and narrow, which increases their length in order to accommodate the chick developing inside. So according to this, if we let Romana have chicks, they would be pretty crappy flyers. Sorry, lady. The research is by no means definitive, and also raises more questions, just like all good research does. Like, why do birds that aren't good at flying, or even fly at all, like ostriches, produce more rounded eggs? And is there a disadvantage to long, pointy eggs that make some species go for that more rounded shape? That question's for the birds. I just hatched that pun. Okay, that one hurt me. I'm extremely sorry. If you just ignore me, I might not whisk another one up. Yeah, I had to look that one up. I poach puns whenever I can. Please help me. I can't stop. Hey guys, well, if you enjoyed this week's journey into beer and cool things, how about helping me keep making the show? Make more good episodes like that one. Hiring me for some voice and or production work can help. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com. That is G-A-R-Y at spulpandeckle.com. Rates are reasonable. And hey, you can rate and review the show on iTunes. The more ratings I have, the more iHabath discoverability will go up for people looking for unique tech podcasts on the iTunes. I'm not just a white dude talking about tech. I talk about beer, too. And you can also support the show with real, honest, and goodest money. Yes, if you believe my 15 to 20 minutes of informative words about beer and tech is something you feel is worth at least $1 a month, you can become my patron. You can do that at patreon.com/iHabitRadio. That is patreon.com/iHABATRADIO. Go to patreon.com/iHabitRadio and throw some money at me! And the Blackberry Farm Brewery's Brett Belgo Belgian IPA is done. Tasty, tasty. So that means it's time to play the end of Stephen O'Brien's Polka for Accordion in C minor and get out of here. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, plants, aliens, ghosts, and even birds about the show and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to Gary@pulpanddeckle.com or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!